Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Some unsettling stories from the 1930s have emerged about what might have happened to families who were displaced by the federal government to make room for the Shenandoah National Park.
Many certainly tried to resist. Many letters that were written to various government officials asking, begging to stay, begging to plant one more garden.
And we'll hear from landowners in Pennsylvania and West Virginia who are struggling to keep their land in the face of proposed gas pipelines.
To which I've told them no. And next step, I suppose, would be what they'd use eminent domain of some kind if they can get away with that.
And there's a story that's been passed around West Virginia for almost 60 years about the time an entire town saw a Black Panther. But it was all a lie. You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're hearing from Appalachians who love their land, their mountains, and their way of life. And we're exploring stories of Appalachians who have been faced and are continuing to face challenges to keep that land and preserve their way of life. We start by looking back to the beginning of the 20th century, before hundreds of Appalachians were forced off their land. See, in the 1930s, the federal government wanted to make room for the Shenandoah National Park. We'll hear more about that struggle in just a minute. Lulu Judd was born in the Blue Ridge Mountains in 1903. She was the oldest of 11 children, and her family fed themselves from the land. In 1975, Lulu Judd spoke with Nancy Smith about growing up in the mountains in an area called Big Meadows.
Well, it was practically all cleared land. It was in pasture and farmland because everybody had their own, they farmed and raised their own food. And we had a cow, most everybody had cows, and you had to feed them. So you had to raise stuff to feed them.
What did you raise besides corn? Like, which vegetables did you raise?
Well, we raised beans, but the bushels and bushels, potatoes, cabbage, turnips, and the biggest turnips and cabbage I've ever seen grow up in that mountain. So sweet and brittle. And potatoes were so different up there, they didn't taste at all like potatoes that you get today.
Oh, really? I wonder what the difference was.
Well, it's just the mountain land that they grew in, rich ground. There was all kinds of berries and fruits up in there you could ever think of. Oh, the chestnuts were so sweet and good up there. The mountains were full of huckleberries. The fields everywhere was full of huckleberries. With my land, you could pick a bushel of huckleberries in no time. I wish you would seen the flowers that people had up in that mountain. Most beautiful flowers you ever looked at. Grandma had flowers that I never saw any like them. There used to be a vine that grew right by the side of her house. And she called it the Martha Washington Rose. It was lavender, and it was about that big around, I'd say. And it was double, just as double as it could be. And it was just a dainty little vine on a dainty little vine, and it just crept all up over those rocks, you know, the thing there. And it was so pretty. Oh, it was beautiful. I never saw any like it before nor after. But there's nothing up there anymore. So that's in the past.
That interview with Lulu Judd is part of the Shenandoah National Park Oral History Collection. It's housed in the special collections at James Madison University. Thanks to withgoodreasonradio.org for providing us with that audio. Now, the area close to Big Meadows is a popular destination for outdoor tourists within the Shenandoah National Park. And while this park allows many people to enjoy the natural beauty of the Blue Ridge Mountains, in the 1930s, hundreds of families were forced off their land to make room for the park. New information has emerged suggesting that some of those displaced people were sent to state colonies and might have even been sterilized. For With Good Reason in Charlottesville, Virginia, Sarah McConnell has this story.
After she moved from Long Island to the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, Margaret Marangioni started hearing stories from neighbors about how their parents and grandparents had been kicked off their land. An English professor at Blue Ridge Community College, Marangioni's curiosity led her to a complex story of displacement, eugenics, and sterilization in Appalachia. Margaret, when did you first become aware that there had been displacement of families who had once lived in the Blue Ridge Parkway area?
From my hiking and coming upon old cemeteries up in the Shenandoah National Park or old chimneys. And then I started doing a little bit more research. So that kind of whet my appetite to, you know, who are these people who are now gone? Mountain farming isn't conducive to a lot of crop growing, but they were able to raise livestock, cattle. There was the tan bark industry before the chestnut blight, where so a lot of people made a living selling chestnuts. But predominantly, they made money, you know, through their farming endeavors, whether it's selling cattle or huckleberries and growing a garden for their family. There wasn't that sense of buy, buy, buy. You know, you supported your family. There was milk on the table. There was food on the table.
What precipitated the actual removal of these families from the mountains?
Well, it started with this idea that they needed to have a park on the East Coast that rivaled, let's say, the parks that are out west. So I guess initially it would be the government. An entrepreneur, George Pollock, who owned and operated Skyland Resort up what is now the Shenandoah National Park, and he put forth that, you know, he had just the right area.
So why remove the people? Why not create this marvelous bucolic national park and let the people continue to farm and live in their homes as they had?
While that may have been talked about, that was quickly dismissed because, of course, the purpose of those national parks are to keep a kind of a pristine natural beauty, and having human habitation kind of is counter to that. And they certainly, I think, at various times may have been led to believe that they were going to be able to stay. But ultimately, in the Park Condemnation Act in 1928, you know, they displaced over 500 families. They did have the choice to sell their land to the park, but they weren't probably given fair market value for their properties.
Is there any indication of how these people felt about losing their land?
Heartbroken and bitter. And I think that is still a prevailing sentiment among many of the descendants. They did not want to sell their land. They did not want to move. You know, some people had been there as early as, or their ancestors had settled there as early as the, you know, mid to late 1700s.
So did they just go, or did they try to resist?
Many certainly tried to resist. Many letters that were written to various government officials asking, begging to stay, begging to plant one more garden. You know, this was a time period of also Tobacco Road, depicting Southerners and especially mountain Southerners as, you know, little Abner and their backward ways as backward. People saw it as a good thing, that these people were going to be modernized, you know, have access to education and health care and jobs, and that somehow their lives that they were living, you know, kind of rural farming, mountain lives, was not a good thing.
Were academics coming into this area to study and learn about these illiterate people?
Yes. I guess, you know, and predominantly, I guess, who becomes kind of the poster child for these academics is a woman by the name of Miriam Sizer. And she worked with the writers of the book Hollow Folk, doing these demographic studies of these hollows. And she kind of describes them as, quote, "These mountaineers have aptly been called our contemporary ancestors. They are modern Robinson Crusoe without his knowledge of civilization. Steeped in ignorance, wrapped in self-satisfaction and complacency, possessed of little or no ambition, little sense of citizenship, little comprehension of law or respect for law, these people present a problem that demands and challenges the attention of thinking men and women."
Oh, that's horrifying. So in the end, it was the government who actually removed the people. Did they do it sort of house by house with people standing there ready to lock the doors and tapping their feet while they gathered their possessions, or what?
For some, it was like that. You know, of course, some that had means to move into the valley decided to make that choice. There were others who did not want to leave, and they were dragged out, and their houses burned in front of their eyes. They were going to resettle many of these people to resettlement communities, which was basically government housing.
Now, some of the people that were displaced actually ended up being pushed into centers where they were ultimately sterilized, right?
Correct. Richard Robinson, in his research, said he found at least 30 people, but he believes there may be more where we're institutionalized and then some of them sterilized. I think the link or the common denominator is, painting a very unflattering picture of people for a larger means or end. The people were written up, like in the Washington Post, the New York Times, various books, as being, inbred, illiterate, cut off from civilization, which were not truisms at all. You can work that to where suddenly these people are not seen as being fit for society. Especially if you take the eugenics movement, which was a proponent that there were people who are not fit for society or reproduction.
So what was the actual process? How were people convinced to undergo sterilization?
Oh, they weren't convinced. Your power was taken away. If you were institutionalized, the process required the superintendent of the facility to say that the individual was afflicted with some type of hereditary form of insanity or imbecility or feeble-minded. That was a big one, feeble-minded, and they should be sterilized. And then it was like a kind of a court process. And then they'd have doctors who supported it. In fact, I have one note from one doctor who said, we saw in the clinic and found her to be well down to the imbecile level. Certainly, there's every reason in the world why this woman should be sterilized. We found no physical defect except some impetigo. However, as both the husband and wife are both minors and wife obviously feeble-minded, we cannot get the gynecological compartment to sterilize her. I think it is too bad that this girl cannot be sterilized with all this trouble, but apparently it cannot be done. That document was from July 18th, 1935, and then she was sent to the colony, I think, on November 1st.
And ultimately sterilized.
Yes. We've got to remember the larger picture here about this park. Yes, it's wonderful to have this untouched section of nature, but at what cost? Some of these people were sterilized, and I remember that this could actually happen.
That was an interview with Margaret Marangoni, who teaches English at Blue Ridge Community College. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Maple syrup is expensive, but just imagine being able to walk outside to tap your own maple trees, then boiling down the sap to make maple syrup on your own land. Some West Virginians are working to tap into this resource. Last week, we heard from one of the farmers named Don Olson, but Olson says he hasn't bottled as much syrup this year. And now, Dominion Energy has plans for a new pipeline that would transport natural gas 550 miles from West Virginia through Virginia and into North Carolina. That pipeline might run right through Olson's maple syrup farm. As our producer Roxy Todd found out, despite the challenges, Olson hopes to hold on to his farm.
This year, Olson is working with a group of maple syrup farmers, the West Virginia Maple Syrup Producers Association. They'll be working to grow the industry by holding workshops, applying for farming grants, and branding West Virginia maple syrup. One of the group's first goals is to get the attention of the USDA, which only surveys the top 10 producing states. The West Virginia maple producers want to show that they belong in the top 10.
West Virginia has not been on that list, but it certainly could, as far as having enough. There's enough maple trees here if more people would be tapping them, that West Virginia would be in that top 10, and there's a little local pride that people want to get on that list.
Cindy Martell works for the West Virginia Department of Agriculture. She's working directly to help the maple syrup producers form the new association.
Essentially, if we can go ahead and work collectively and build a brand, that's what we're hoping for, is that maple syrup production ends up making an economic impact on the state, because we know we have the potential based on the number of untapped resources, but also in terms of, adding revenue to farmers. When we're sugaring, that's in February, March, April. Those are great times. Because we're not doing other things on the farm, or we're getting ready to farm, and makes that income distribution throughout the year a little more even.
Maple syrup farmers in West Virginia, like Don Olson, certainly aren't having any problem finding buyers for their syrup. Olson says that the demand far exceeds his production.
We're not trying to track down every little venue we could sell it to anymore. Local people just put in their orders. You know, a lot of people say, I want two gallons this spring. You know, they plan ahead. They want, that's a supply for the year for them.
One of his main challenges right now is meeting that demand. He says that with the last two winters giving him a much shorter season, he just hasn't produced as much as he'd like. But lately, he's had a more pressing threat to his farm. A letter arrived in the mail recently from Dominion Energy.
That's a letter. They want a survey through here.
Dominion Energy has proposed a high-pressure pipeline called the Atlantic Coast Pipeline that would transport natural gas to markets in North Carolina. They want Olson's permission to survey his property.
To which I've told them no. And next step, I suppose, would be what they'd use, eminent domain of some kind, if they can get away with that, to where they could survey through here.
Chet Wade is a spokesperson for Dominion Energy.
In some cases, we've been able to work with landowners to adjust the route because they've been able to identify for us certain key features of their property.
But Don Olson worries that his small maple syrup farm would be utterly destroyed if a 42-inch pipeline were built on his property. We walk through his forest, and he shows me the 40-year-old maple trees. Plastic tubing crisscrosses and follows a line down to his sugar house. He's using the money he makes during the syrup season to build a retirement fund.
And it just occurred to me, well, maybe these trees are that for me. And it kind of worked out, you know. I'm about retirement age, and now I've got an income from these trees. No 401ks still, but but the trees are helping out.
But that retirement money is entirely dependent on these trees. If they were removed to make room for a right-of-way for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, it would take decades for new trees to grow back. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Blue Rock.
And another interstate gas pipeline that would run through Appalachia is the Mountain Valley Pipeline, LLC. That company sent out letters threatening legal action against property owners who refused access to their land for surveying. Groups opposed to the pipeline believe there's no basis for legal action. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Jesse Wright looked into it and found out the issue appears to be far from black and white.
The Mountain Valley Pipeline, or MVP, is a proposed 42-inch diameter, 330-mile line that would connect hydraulic fracturing operations in West Virginia to a transmission pipeline in Virginia. EQT and NextEra Energy are partnering on the project. Elise Keaton is with the Greenbrier River Watershed Association, which is opposed to the Mountain Valley Pipeline's construction. The association held a meeting on February 28th in Ireland, Lewis County, to discuss the pipeline's impact. About 70 people gathered at the town's shamrock-themed community center. After the meeting, Keaton said her organization had received calls the previous day from landowners in four counties who had been mailed letters from the pipeline company.
So what we saw with these letters is a misinterpretation of the facts, in our opinion.
Keaton believes the crux of the issue is West Virginia's eminent domain law and whether it can be applied during the surveying stage of the pipeline's development.
The letter implies that under West Virginia State Code Section 54-1-1, which is West Virginia's eminent domain statute, that the gas companies have a right to come on and survey. As we read the statute, that doesn't come into play until eminent domain is granted.
Because the pipeline crosses state boundaries, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, is overseeing its development. It's FERC's job to determine whether the pipeline's benefits outweigh its adverse effects. If the application is approved, eminent domain likely wouldn't be granted until sometime in 2016. A few landowners at the meeting said they don't want surveyors on their property but are very concerned about the threat of legal action. Lawyer Joe Lovett with Appalachian Mountain Advocates is representing some landowners who have received the letters.
It certainly is a threat. I mean, it says if you don't let us on, we're going to sue you. I don't know what could be more of a threat than that. I mean, that's a clear threat.
We reached out to MVP for specifics about the threat of legal action. EQT spokeswoman Natalie Cox declined an on-air interview and instead issued a statement on behalf of the Mountain Valley Pipeline Company. Cox says MVP is trying to work with landowners to resolve their concerns, but legal action may be necessary to move the surveying forward. She didn't offer any details about the company's plans for legal action. Cox did, however, emphasize the importance of conducting the surveys. MVP says those surveys will determine the route that has the least overall impact on the environment, landowners, and cultural and historic resources. Lovett, however, says it doesn't matter how useful the surveys are to the MVP project, the letters still amount to bullying.
MVP has to comply with the law. It just can't come on and intimidate people and say, well, you know, if you don't let us on now, we're not going to consider all those kinds of things that are good for you. I mean, this is your one chance, buddy. You let us on your property, or we're going to screw you later. Is that really what the message from MVP? I don't think so. I think that better not be its message. Its message should be we're here to work with landowners and comply with the law.
To help us put the survey issue in perspective, we spoke with West Virginia University Associate Professor Jesse Richardson. He's a land use lawyer who has experience with eminent domain. He says West Virginia's statute is very old and there isn't much legal precedent for these cases.
There's a lot of gray area.
Richardson says that all things considered, MVP could have grounds for legal action. He says it would be up to a circuit court judge whether the company has the right to survey without a landowner's permission at this stage in the pipeline's development. Back at the meeting, Keaton says it would be in the community's interest to see how that legal action plays out.
I think we need to know where this line is and whether or not the state statute does in fact allow this without eminent domain or if they need to wait for the federal declaration of eminent domain.
Keaton stressed that landowners should never sign anything from a pipeline company without consulting a lawyer first. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jesse Wright in Morgantown.
We'll hear more stories about landowners and environmentalists confronting gas companies and police in the second half of our show. The annual Appalachian Studies Conference is in Johnson City, Tennessee this weekend. Last year's keynote speaker was writer Silas House. In his talk, which combined poetry and musical performance, House spoke about discrimination against the LGBT or lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community in Appalachia. He pointed out that Appalachia should be leading the nation in its inclusion of people of all backgrounds, races, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Here's an excerpt from the speech by Silas House.
Appalachia is America. We always have been. Yet we've always been America underneath a microscope. So often we see Americans who are disgusted with us as a region. We see vitriol spewed against us as a culture in the media, in online comments, in open conversation. When the West Virginia chemical spill happened earlier this year, people called into talk shows and said it was our fault for being such stupid hillbillies. I believe that the main reason for this open disgust with this region is because we are a mirror being held up to the rest of the country. We reveal all of its homophobia and racism and misogyny and everything else that is bad about us as a region, as a nation, just as we reveal what is good about us as a nation. The reflection is sometimes hard to take, and Appalachia has always been the scapegoat in this struggle between American self-love and self-hatred.
That was Silas House, who is the nationally best-selling author of 5 novels, 3 plays, and a work of creative nonfiction. He lives in Berea, Kentucky, where he serves as the NEH Chair in Appalachian Studies at Berea College. Last fall, the town of Berea, Kentucky, did not pass a non-discrimination ordinance that would have protected LGBT people from being fired or tossed out of their homes because of their sexual orientation. This week for What's in a Name, we're featuring a very small town to pass a fairness ordinance. Here's a hint. The population of this town is only 6 people, and 80% of the town is actually maintained by the National Park Service. It's also the site where the movie Made One was filmed. So what's the town's name and what's the story behind its name? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Thank you.
your Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. Thurmond, West Virginia, incorporated in 1903, it was once a booming railroad town. It had an opera house, a saloon, and hundreds of visitors each week, as well as hundreds of residents. But as the coal industry faded, so did the town as people left to find work outside of Thurmond. The town sits along the New River, which has been designated as a heritage river by the National Park Service. The town appears virtually untouched by modern development, and there are just 6 permanent residents. Our producer, Roxy Todd, visited this forest community last weekend. She spoke with Melissa Dragan, one of only 6 permanent residents in Thurmond. Dragan says the town gets its name from a surveyor who worked for the C&O Railroad.
Thurmond got its name from Captain William Dabney Thurmond, who was a surveyor. He was working for the railroad, so the process was to get the railroad put in and established and functioning, and then it became the transport for coal mines further down through the gorge.
That was Melissa Dragan, who was born and raised in the town of Thurmond. She's also one of the town council members who voted in favor of a non-discrimination ordinance. Every single town council member of Thurmond did.
We didn't want it to be another law that was on the books that would never be used. We wanted it to be thoughtful and meaningful and something that would benefit anyone.
If you have another story about Thurmond, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Next, we head to Ohio, where another proposed pipeline project is drawing opposition from landowners concerned about their safety and property rights. The Nexus pipeline would run 250 miles from gas wells in southeast Ohio through the state to Michigan and Canada. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that it's drawing opposition from landowners concerned about their safety and property rights.
Paul Jaroski isn't what you might expect in an anti-pipeline activist. He's a businessman. He and his wife Elizabeth have been renovating their dream home in fast-growing Medina County in northeast Ohio for the past 2 years. Sitting among the trees, it's got the feel of an upscale cabin with wood-beam ceilings and large windows.
We wanted to be able to see the land because it's so beautiful. So really from every room, you can see outside and see the property.
But before they even finished moving in, the Jaroskis got a notice. Their new property was in what's called a study corridor for the Nexus pipeline. Nexus is a joint venture of DTE Energy of Michigan and Spectra Energy of Houston. The pipeline would start in southeastern Ohio and head north and west through their property, as well as hundreds of others, on its way to Michigan and Canada. The company wants to survey the Jaroskis' front yard to see if they can dig it up to lay their new line. The more the Jaroskis looked into it, the more upset they got.
So our first concern started out to be safety.
It would be 42 inches wide. Jaroski holds his arms high and wide in the air above his head.
You understand how big this pipeline is?
Jaroski worries what would happen if someone accidentally shoveled into it.
You know, the experts are saying there's so much pressure that the heat, okay, that's going to come through a small crack or a small orifice is going to self-ignite. So we're going to have an explosion.
He and a coalition of other concerned citizens from around the state have joined together to get the pipeline rerouted through a less densely populated area. And they've convinced many local township and county governments to join them. 300 concerned landowners, farmers, local officials, and others showed up at a pipeline meeting held by Nexus this week. 100 blue-shirted Nexus representatives were there, ready to answer questions. Still, Maureen Hardy was disheartened. She got notice in recent months that a pipeline compression station was planned near her house. She didn't even know what that was, but she's worried it will be loud and polluting.
I've talked to several different people from Nexus and gotten several different answers.
Nexus spokesman Arthur Dietzel says the company is holding meetings like this all month to hear concerns before finalizing the pipeline route.
There's nothing set in stone. This route will continue to evolve over the course of the next year.
Nexus has started the permitting process through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, which needs to approve the pipeline route. FERC's Joanne Walkholder is manager of the government's review.
We have engineers that review safety. We have biologists like myself that review the waters and wetlands and endangered species and vegetation.
But some landowners at the meeting don't believe FERC will address their concerns. Mario Pasolini lives in Seville, a small farming community. He says FERC will approve Nexus.
There's no doubt about it. They're in the business to rubber stamp pipelines.
Pasolini and landowners he's joined with want to stop the pipeline from being built. He plans to fight Nexus in court. If they try to take his property, he plans to argue that eminent domain is only supposed to be used for a public use, like a highway or railroad.
This is a private Fortune 500 company called Spectra Energy, and they're in this to make money.
Pasolini says the gas is heading for Canada, and it's not going to be a public good in Ohio. Nexus says they're already talking with possible gas customers along the pipeline routes. Paul Jaroski's coalition of landowners isn't trying to stop the project. They're pushing to create a pipeline safety corridor. Nexus is one of at least four pipelines currently proposed in the same general direction through Ohio. Jaroski wants them to be co-located away from population centers, as well as rivers, forests, and other natural areas.
Because the companies would not be coming through this neighborhood and needing the power of eminent domain to locate their pipes, because the corridor would already be established.
Jaroski says back in October, all he cared about was keeping the pipeline off his own property. Now he's come to care about the farmers, parents, and other people in his coalition, and he wants to protect them all. Nexus plans to submit a formal application to FERC later this year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Some say it's a backward place. Narrow minds on the narrow way. But I make it a point to say that's where I come from. Yeah, that's where I come from.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. If you're just joining us, well, you missed a few things, but that's okay. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast. All of our recent shows are available for download for free, and it's available on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. Subscribing to the podcast is easy. We posted a link on the top of our web post for today's show, and again, that's wvpublic.org. Ever since the fracking boom took off, there have been protesters keeping a close eye on the industry, raising questions about the environmental effects of the practice. Now, as fracking expands, so has community resistance in some places. Some police departments are working with the oil and gas industry to keep a close eye on protesters themselves. The surveillance is happening in drilling hotspots like Pennsylvania, Texas, and the Rockies. Marie Cusick of WITF in Harrisburg has the story.
Wendy Lee is a college philosophy professor and vocal anti-fracking activist in Pennsylvania. She's always protested peacefully, which is why she was stunned last winter when a state trooper came to her home to ask her about eco-terrorism and pipe bombs.
Part of me was like, oh, this is scary. And part of me is just laughing on the inside because it's ludicrous.
The trooper was investigating an alleged trespassing incident, which involved Lee and two other activists visiting a gas compressor. She says they'd stayed on a public road and left when security guards told them to go away. Lee was never charged with anything and believes the trooper's visit was simply to intimidate her.
They're clearly there to send the message that they protect the industry.
The same Pennsylvania trooper had traveled to upstate New York to question another activist who was with Lee at the compressor. When Jeremy Alderson got a knock at his door, a New York State trooper was there too.
Having two troopers show up at your door when you can't imagine anything you've done wrong, that's kind of scary because you don't know what's happened.
Alderson was never charged with anything and also felt the visit was meant to intimidate him. The Pennsylvania trooper, Mike Hudson, declined to comment for this story, as did the state police. But documents obtained by member station WITF through an open records request show he's part of a broader intelligence-sharing network between the oil and gas industry and federal, state, and local law enforcement. It's called the Marcellus Shale Operators Crime Committee. Similar partnerships have sprung up in other oil and gas plays around the country, places like South and East Texas and the Rocky Mountains. Some of the biggest drilling companies in the U.S. work closely with FBI task forces to monitor potential threats.
I would say that first and foremost, our job and what we think about is protecting people.
That's Jim Beaver, a retired Pennsylvania State Police trooper. Although he never worked on energy issues or eco-terrorism, he spent much of his time as an investigator. There have been reports of pipe bombs, charred debris, and gunshots fired at gas sites in Pennsylvania, but the incidents have not been publicly linked to activists. Beaver says people without criminal records can still turn to violence.
We always try to maintain the balance of gathering information, doing our job, and keeping in mind the rights of the people, keeping in mind the Constitution.
But not everyone agrees police are striking the right balance. Paul Rossi is an attorney for an anti-fracking group in northeastern Pennsylvania, which recently settled a lawsuit with the state after it was erroneously labeled a terrorist threat back in 2010. Rossi says he's disturbed to hear about the ongoing surveillance.
I'm about as flabbergasted as an attorney can be at the serial violations of First Amendment rights in this state.
Partnerships between industry and the police are not exactly new. The Pennsylvania State Police were formed to quell violence between mining companies and their workers. But the Pennsylvania State Police do have a proud history of protecting the public, says West Virginia University College of Law professor Patrick McGinley.
But that history doesn't have to be whitewashed. And historically, there were abuses.
Activists like college professor Wendy Lee believe those abuses continue to this day. She filed an open records request with the state police to try to find out why she was questioned. Her request was denied because the documents are part of an ongoing criminal investigation.
You know, while we get to continue to believe that we have the free exercise of our First Amendment rights, we're not actually supposed to use them.
Lee still hopes to get the records and is appealing the decision. For NPR News, I'm Marie Cusick.
Newspapers have traditionally played an important role in delivering information that matters to a community. Whether it be a pipeline proposal or young farmers, whatever the local news is, one rural newspaper has played this role for 140 years. Yes, there are some listening to this that might say, nobody even reads the hard copy or paper newspaper anymore. But even in our world of social media and news websites, some rural communities in Appalachia still get their local news by reading their weekly newspaper. Monroe County is one of those communities. For the Traveling 219 Project, Gibbs Kinderman talked with the current editor of the Monroe Watchman, Craig Moeller, about the paper's origins in the unsettled years after the Civil War.
The Watchman started in 1872, and it was originally called the Border Watchman. It was started by a fellow by the name of Albert Fowler, and he only had it a few years, and then Charles Johnson came in from the Valley, Virginia, and purchased it, I believe it was in 1876.
Why did he call it the Border Watchman?
It was, of course, just after the Civil War, and I don't know for sure, but I assume that that probably had something to do with it, since we were on the Virginia border, and the new state of West Virginia would have been created only eight or nine years before that. So I think that the war and the border between what had been the Union and the Confederacy probably had something to do with it.
Craig's dad, H.H. Moeller, started his career at the Watchman at an early age.
Actually, my dad started working here while he was in high school and then went away to prep school and actually attended a couple years at the Naval Academy, but there were some issues in the family and he didn't finish at the academy. So he came back here, and he was just interested in the paper and always sort of loved it and actually had, I think, told a few of his friends at the academy that he wanted to come back to Union and run the paper at some point in his life.
Craig's great-grandfather had a connection to the Watchman as well.
He had also worked here as a typesetter, and we had no idea of that. My dad never knew that until we happened to run across the obituary in the paper. But he would have been a typesetter here probably in the early 1900s, maybe up until about 1908.
So you were born with printer's ink in your blood.
Yeah, I guess so. I hung around a lot here when I was younger. It was sort of fun to come in and watch what they were doing and work with the school paper in high school. And, of course, we printed it here. So we'd come in and help stuff inserts after school on the mailing day when I was in high school and junior high some. So, yeah, it's sort of been a part of me, I guess.
Neither daily newspapers nor TV stations cover Monroe County news, so residents depend on the paper to keep up with local happenings, and the paper depends on them to help decide what is newsworthy. So in a way, you're kind of like a community access cable operation. It seems like you accommodate people's personal agendas in terms of getting stuff out.
Yeah, we really try to, and a lot of the stuff is submitted for the paper. We have a small staff. It's still a family-run business. We only have four full-time employees, two family members, my mother and I, and then two additional employees. And, it's hard to get out, actually, and we don't have an assigned reporter that can spend all of their time out on the road trying to cover things. So big things we hear about, we try to go cover, but an awful lot of the stuff we get is sent in by readers who want the information in the paper. So, I think that's certainly a part of the service that that a community paper can provide.
The Watchman has a lot of local history in its pages and runs a feature called The Farmer's Friend and Fireside Companion in honor of a long-gone Monroe County paper, which was founded in 1853. This year, Craig's proud mother, Dale Moeller, celebrates her 50th anniversary as an owner of the paper. Mrs. Moeller, the Watchman's publisher and general manager, has become a part of Monroe County tradition herself. And Craig hopes the rising generation of Moellers will help carry on the family newspaper tradition.
I really don't know. I hope it can stay in the family. We haven't quite caught up with the Johnsons yet. They had three editors in a row, and so far we only have two. But with my kids, if they're interested, I'd love to have them here at some point. If they're not, I have four nephews, and maybe some of them will be. And if that doesn't happen either, then I guess we'll just sort of have to see what the future holds.
For Traveling 219 and West Virginia Public Radio, this is Gibbs Kinderman.
Another rural newspaper in West Virginia that's remained in existence for generations is the Pocahontas Times, based in Marlinton, West Virginia. And the longtime editor of that paper, Calvin Price, believed until his death in the 1950s that panthers still existed in the forests of West Virginia. And he isn't the only one. Throughout rural areas of Appalachia, many people stick to their stories, claiming to have seen mountain lions themselves. In West Virginia, the Department of Natural Resources denies the authenticity of these sightings, and yet the stories persist. Why? Well, Jesse Wright Mendoza, former reporter for the Traveling 219 Project, has been researching the history of a famous panther hoax that took place in Richwood, West Virginia, involving old Cal Price and Richwood newspaper editor Jim Comstock. KCRW's show Unfictional picked up this story in a recent episode and sent it to us to share with you. This is the story of the Great West Virginia Panther Hoax, featuring the voices of Richwooders Maxine Corbett, Alan Barker, and Jay Comstock, with narration by Miles Stroth.
I'd like to ask you something. Have you ever seen a black panther in West Virginia? Actually, has anyone? Well, most any expert would tell you no, you didn't. But for decades, panther sightings have been reported around West Virginia hill towns. In fact, there's one Black Panther story that borders on legend. Some people call it the Great Panther Hoax.
You always have someone. I just saw that panther the other day, but you know they didn't. And that happened here.
Now, most of this story is true. But you know how it goes when a story gets passed around. A few little decorations might get added on here or there.
It was in the 1950s. Jim Comstock was a newspaper man.
Probably the greatest promoter of West Virginia and Richwood who's ever lived. Some people liked him and some people absolutely despised him. It was the strangest thing. You either loved him or you hated him, it seemed.
Comstock took after another West Virginia newspaper guy, Cal Price. Price lived on the other side of Kennison Mountain, edited the Pocahontas Times. He had made a lot of friends over the years and developed a reputation.
Cal Price had three very strong beliefs. Number one,
no newspaper should ever sell liquor ads. Number two, West Virginians had no regard for good topsoil. And the third one, there were panthers in the mountains of West Virginia.
One day, Jim's phone rang. The man on the other end was a fellow by the name of Dr. Burt. Dr. Burt had come up with an idea.
To order a panther out of Mexico.
A trick they could play on their panther-obsessed friend.
Dr. Burt wanted to bring it in, turn it loose on Kinnison Mountain, and as soon as it came out of its cage, shoot it. And tell Cal Price, here's your panther. He wanted Jim Comstock to get a picture of it, and they could spread it all over the United States. And Jim didn't think much of it.
So he agreed. But poor Jim Comstock had no idea what he was really in for.
So the good Dr. Burt got a trapper in Mexico to trap a panther and send it to West Virginia.
It was set to arrive in a few weeks. Plan was this. They would release it near some unsuspecting hunters on the mountain. And then, blammo, they killed the cat and haul it back to the center of town. But something happened. Jim picked up a newspaper and read some tough news.
He saw where Cal Price had died.
Before he ever got to see a panther.
He called the doctor and he said, well, Cal Price is dead. You can just forget about the whole thing. The doctor said, there's one problem. The order had already been filled and the panther's on the way. Jim figures, oh boy.
West Virginia was getting a panther after all.
So Jim calls one of the local sportsmen, a man by the name of Ed Buck.
Chief of the fire department.
He was probably the most honest man I've ever met. He was a hunter and a fisherman. He knew everything about the backcountry. Mr. Comstock called him and said, Ed, we've got this panther. What are we going to do with it?
The doctor, he said, I want the hide for my den, a panther hide.
Ed Buck said, no. It's too beautiful an animal to destroy. You don't kill something just because it was an inconvenience.
So Dr. Burt backed off and went back to where he came from. But Ed and Jim decided to keep the hoax going. Hell, it'd be a fitting tribute to their fallen friend.
They took this box with the panther on it to Kinnison Mountain.
Ed called in a couple other local hunters, told them he needed help with a panther he had caught up on the mountain.
Unloaded it at the fire department.
And told the townspeople that they had trapped a panther.
Got it inside and everybody was looking at it and trying to figure out what to do next.
Finally, they set up the panther in City Hall.
The local funeral director donated one of the shipping boxes that caskets come in. They took the top off of it and nailed chain link fence over it. Then they had the fun of getting Kitty into that box.
Meanwhile, Jim rushed home. He hammered out a story for the next day's paper. Panther caught on Kinnison Mountain. Well, the next morning,
there was a crowd gathering in front of the city hall.
Everyone wanted to see a West Virginian panther in the flesh.
Big sign hanging out. See the panther captured on Kinnison Mountain. $1 for adults, 25 cents for children.
Proceeds go into the fire department, of course.
Because the fire department does need money. They always do.
If you were on the street anywhere, if you had friends, you knew there was the panther in a box down at City Hall that you could go see, believe me, because in Richwood, news travels fast, and especially in that time. A neighbor would be out and see it, and they'd tell the neighbor, and then that neighbor would tell another neighbor, and before long, everybody in Richwood knew the panther was down there.
At his office, Jim's phone was ringing off the hook.
The Charleston Daily Mail and the Charleston Gazette, both papers called and asked, what is going on?
He said, if Ed Buck says that he trapped the panther, we'll let it go with that.
But when the hunters helped Ed bring the panther to town, things didn't add up.
If Ed trapped that panther and then got him in that box, Ed should have been tore all pieces. ground wasn't scuffed up. No signs of a struggle of the cat. No tracks. Nothing.
Reporters were calling Fire Chief Ed Buck, too, pushing him for details on how he trapped the panther. Now, Ed was an upstanding citizen and a good Christian. Lying just wasn't in his nature. The calls kept coming in. The questions piled up. Eventually, Ed Buck cracked. He told the Daily Mail that, actually, he hadn't trapped that panther. The Daily Mail called Jim.
And Jim had nothing else to do but admit that it was a hoax. Half of the town of Richwood was ready to lynch Ed Buck. The other half called him a saint because he kept the panther from being killed.
Ed was just this icon. He didn't tell a lie. I mean, he was like George Washington. He never told a lie. And people were disappointed in him, I think, more than anything else, that he had gone along with the hoax.
They had to have a discussion. What are we going to do now? They couldn't kill it, didn't want to kill it, couldn't turn it loose. So somebody came up with the idea, the game farm at French Creek. And so in a very short time, the panther got a new home.
The Charleston papers maligned Jim Comstock.
A newspaper's taken in on a hoax. I mean, they had headlines too. Panther found on Kennison Mountain. They were embarrassed.
Dr. Burke was not a towner. He never got his share of blame for the whole thing.
The panther hoax lived with Jim Comstock the rest of his life, even though he didn't start it. But I've never known a newspaper person to pass up the chance for a good story anytime they get one.
One day, Jim got a call from Walt Disney Studios. They wanted to make the story into a movie. Thing was, they wanted to change the panther into a bear. Jim told them to go to hell.
That's our show for this week. We hope you check out our website where there are more photos and videos from the stories you heard today. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from With Good Reason and the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front, NPR, and KCRW's show Unfictional. Music in today's show was provided by Ben Townsend, Dog and Gun, Andy Agnew Jr., Walt Koken, and Mac McAnally with Back Where I Come From, as heard on Mountain Stage from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.